Liveline on RTE Radio 1, sponsored by Harry Curry. Discover luxurious duvet sets today. Visit harrycurry.com for stylish comfort this spring.
Hello, good afternoon. You're welcome to Liveline. Cullum O'Mungine here, 51551 for your texts, joe@rte.ie for your emails, 087 484 8888 for your WhatsApps. Martin, good afternoon to you.
Good afternoon. How are you?
Good, thanks. On a fine sunny day like this, you should be celebrating the solar panels on your roof, but maybe not so at the moment. Go back to 2018, 2019, Martin, and tell us when you began the journey of installing solar panels and how it rolled out.
Yeah, well, we started back in 2018. We were upgrading the house. We got an architect, we got the builders to, you know, the house had to be completely gutted. So, you know, we got the outside insulation, inside everything. So we were hoping to get it A1 rated. And to complete that journey, we were looking for solar panels. So we spoke to the builder contractor and then the architect. And at that time, 6 years ago, you know, it was only in its infancy. It was only a new, basically, solar panels were only new to the market. So the architect said to me to ring the SEAI, as they would be, they're the expert in it. Right,
that's the sustainable.
So I rang them.
The Sustainable Energy Authority of Ireland, the SEAI.
So I phoned them, and they directed me to their portal. So on their portal, they said you can pick a contractor from their portal, and he will install the solar PV panels for you. So went to the portal, picked someone directly from, you know, the first guy, he was in Dublin, he was working in the Leinster area, picked him. So he came, he did the works very, you know, the works were grand, there wasn't a problem with them. They seemed to be working fine. And then an SEAI inspector came out, he inspected the work, he said, you know, there's a few problems here, this had to be marked, this wire needs, you know, upgrading. Small, minute things. And then he said to the contractor, you know, can you sign off in this form? The installer. And the other said, I can't sign off on it. And the inspector was saying, well, why can't you sign off? I said, well, I'm not registered. An electrical contractor, I'm not registered with Recce. It was Recce at the time. I believe they changed it since.
It's called Safe Electric Ireland now.
Safe Electric Ireland. Yes, that's what I believe.
How much had you spent at this stage, Martin?
I had spent about 5,500 at this stage. You know, so the work was more or less finished. This was the last job to get the inspector comes out. It's to be signed off, and the report has to be signed off. But he was unable to sign off because he wasn't a registered electrical contractor.
Right. So he was on the Sustainable Energy Authority of Ireland's portal for approved contractors to carry out works that would be compliant with an SEAI grant. But when it came time to sign off on that work, you found out he had to be also registered with Safe Electric Ireland, or Recce, as it was then called, in order to be compliant with drawing down the grant.
Yes, yes. That's really it in a nutshell, yes.
So, when you went on the portal, what did you understand an approved contractor to mean?
When I went on the portal, you know, the SEAI are the experts. What I was expecting now, what I thought, an approved electrical, an approved installer, was somebody that was recommended by the SEAI and could carry out the necessary work, and also, more importantly, sign off on the work that they completed.
Right. And so, did you find another contractor who was registered with Safe Electric Ireland, who was happy to sign off on the work?
Well, you know, there was a bit of a set to in the kitchen, and the SEAI, the inspector, he came up with the idea, why don't you get someone else to sign off on it? But as you know, I rang one, maybe two, and I was told under no circumstances would any reputable contractor sign off on someone else's work. You know, and they if anything went wrong, they would be, you know, they would be liable for work that they didn't complete. So I was at that stage, I was just a snooker. There was no way forward and there was no way back, and I was at the loss of the grant.
And the grant was worth how much? You've already paid 5,500 up front. What was the grant?
I think from what I can gather, the grant was worth 1,200, which is roughly, you know, you're talking 20-odd% of the work.
Right.
You know.
So what did you do?
When you think...
Did you appeal that, or did you just, you know, unhappily take the hit?
At the time, there was a lot of phone calls between the SAEI and myself. And they more or less said, "But if you can't sign off on it, you know." And then the pressure came on. They were looking to meet some deadlines, and the pressure came on. So I got a phone call. Eventually, I got a phone call and said, "Your grant has been refused."
Right.
I got a verbal confirmation that the grant was to be refused.
So that was the end of the €1,200 coming from the Sustainable Authority of Ireland. But fast forward to 2024, you decide you want to upgrade the solar panels on your roof. So talk us through that.
Yeah. My wife and I were talking, you know, we were talking about, and we were watching some program about upgrades in solar panels, how much more powerful they are. They can, you know, they can produce a lot more electricity than they did back in 6 or 7 years ago. So we decided to upgrade. We rang a reputable company who apparently advised the SEIA on solar PV panels. So we went to them, and they said, "Well, we look after the grant for you." And as they went to apply for the second grant in 2024, they rang me and said, "There's a problem with there's a problem here with the SAEI." And I said, "Well, I'm not sure why there's a problem." And he said, "Well, they told me to contact the SAEI. And so I phoned them, and they told me because we had previously applied, I wasn't entitled to a new grant.
But even though you'd never drawn down the €1,200 grant the first time you'd spent €5,500,
no.
You'd never drawn it down, but now you were being told you're ineligible for a grant when you had all your ducks in a row with a new contractor, that you weren't eligible for it because you'd already submitted an application for a previous grant.
Yes, that's basically what they told me. And I was told that it's in their terms and conditions. And I asked them on a few occasions to explain to me where these terms and conditions are, and I still haven't been told, and I still can't find them. But it's somewhere buried, it's somewhere buried in the small print.
Right. And had you paid out again for the upgrade of the solar panels?
No.
You were looking for pre-approval of the grant, is it?
I'm looking for pre-approval again. Works can't start on solar panels and this stuff without pre-approval. So if you start work and it's not pre-approved by the SAEI, you won't get the grant.
All right.
So you can't, you're virtually in limbo until they say yay or nay.
Right.
And that's the way it works.
So because you'd you'd previously refused, that's why you were turned down this time.
Yes.
Now look, for anyone who goes on the SEAI website, it says step one, if you want solar panels improved, it says step one, find a solar PV company. And it says you will need to use, and in bold print it says, an SEAI registered solar PV company. And it says companies are registered with the SEAI based on a commitment to, amongst other things, it says adherence to a professional code of practice. And then when it comes to talking about making the request for payment, which is step five, and the submission of documents, it said what needs to be submitted. It says your solar PV company will submit to the SEAI all the documents required to make a request for payment. So it puts the onus on the company. It says they will submit, and it includes amongst the things that they talk about, a Safe Electric recce copy of the certificate. And when it goes on to documentation that you might be given, it said documents that you receive may include some of the following. This is from the contractor that's carried out the works. And again, the Safe Electric copy of the certificate is one of them. But it says it, you know, they may only give it to you, but they're putting the onus on the company to submit that. And the registered company is supposed to be in compliance with all of the SEAI terms and conditions. That's how you understood it would work, is it?
Yes, that's how I understood it would work. Absolutely. You know, my wife, we put our faith in the portal. So the question is, like, who's looking after the portal? Who's checking the portal? Who's on this system, on their portal? And I was over and back with them for months, and I keep going back to the same thing. Did you check this contractor? And I got no answer. And that was back in 2018. We got no answer. And it's the same again. From what I can gather, the same guy is on the portal.
Right.
And the same guy, and he could be carrying out work, and he could be carrying out works for other people, and other people could be getting caught.
Right. Now, we did put in for a request to the SEI, and we said, was it made clear to customers on the SEI site that the onus is on them to check that installers are recce registered? And it says the obligation on the homeowner is to choose a company that's registered with the SEAI, which you did. And then it says, mm-hmm. after that, the obligation is on the company to only use recce Safe Electric certified installers. This is not just an SEAI requirement, but a requirement under electrical regulations. Now, I don't know how much policing of that or, you know, inspection of jobs is done, but in your case, you signed up to a registered contractor. Were you aware at all that you had any obligation to check the status of the contractor that was being used by the company?
No. We weren't aware of that. We put our absolute faith in the SEAI's portal. Our absolute faith, you know. And it's the same, you know, I'd be the same with the bank. I put my absolute faith in the bank to mind my money and to charge me what they need to charge and to do what they, you know, with my money. I put faith in these institutions. The SEAI, you know, when you go to these home improvement show, they're always there. I'm looking at them, a billboard. So they're a state body. Mm. So we put our absolute, you know, faith in this. And now the question was, we asked, who's looking after that portal? You know, who's checking that goes on, that's going on to the portal? Can anybody just rack up and say, I'm a solar PV installer and away we go?
Well, they say on their site, they say the companies that are registered with the SEAI, it's based on a commitment that installing the works in accordance with the technical specifications, adherence to a professional code of practice, which in the case of this would involve an electrician, whatever code of practice that is, demonstrated tax compliance and insurance, use of a standard contract with the homeowner, competency to install and commission the works, and installing a size appropriate system. Now, we did ask them, why is it not a condition that any installer or contractor listed on the SEAI portal to install solar panels are recce or Safe Electric registered? And it says, when a company registered with SEAI, they must also register the installers they will use. These installers can only be registered if they have a recce or a Safe Electric cert. But I suppose this is the key line. Any company registering with the SEAI must have at least one in-house registered installer, but they're also free to use additional registered installers to support their workload. So to get on the portal, you only need one Safe Electric Ireland registered installer.
Yes, that would appear to be the case. Yeah, that would appear to be the case.
And in your case, you didn't get the installer. Whoever that registered installer was in the company that you used, that's not who came out to your house that day and put the solar panels up on the roof and wired them up.
No, the company that I used, he was a sole trader. He was doing absolutely everything. So he was in the end. He was dealing with the books. He was doing, you know, he was the only. Right. He was the company. The installer was the company. But you know, was there any checks carried out on him? But you know, if you're going back, I've received a letter from them last week. And in this letter, it says, you know, I can see from our record your revision application that that the company you selected was registered with SEAI. It said, however, they failed to register as an installer, which is a prerequisite of completing works on the scheme. So they, you know, they were aware back in 2000 that there was a problem here. Mm. And, you know, we picked him from the portal. But, you know,
it doesn't seem to be clear from the text of that letter. As you say, it says, however, they had failed to register as an installer. But it says companies registered with the SEAI are for their portal are based on a commitment to installing the works in accordance with technical specifications and adherence to a professional code of practice. So reading that portal, I suppose listeners could see why you assumed that this person met all of the criteria necessary for putting a solar panel up on a roof.
Absolutely, absolutely. You know, but we put all our faith into this portal. And the SEAI, you know, they're the only people out there, you know, that are market leaders or they're a state body. So we put our absolute faith that what was on their system was what was required. He would have been fully recce it would have been a recce installer. He was, you know, he was able to sign off on the necessary paperwork. But when it landed, when the paperwork landed on the SAI, the inspector is there and the installer is there, and I'm standing, I'm looking, hold on, there's a problem here. So it really got, you know, and it got messy, and it's been messy since.
Right. But you could also read from the letter that because of what happened the first time you tried to get solar panels installed, that the entire application was null and void. So it's not that you were refused a grant, it was just an invalid application, and you should have been entitled to apply again using a contractor that was fully compliant with all of the terms and conditions that you're talking about. But now you're after finding out that you can't.
Yeah. Oh, well, I'm not sure what way the SAI work, but the impression I'm getting is because you have to be pre-approved. And because I was pre-approved, now that precludes me from applying a second time.
Right. But you never drew down the grant.
No, I never got any grant. I got a phone call one day and said, "Mr. Gretton, your application has been dismissed." And that's basically what's happened. You know, there was very little paperwork. There's very little paperwork when you're dealing with it. There's a lot of phone calls. There's very little paper trail. And when you go back to them, you know, well, what happened 6 years ago? But they've recorded their phone calls, and that's what I don't. But I know for a fact the last phone call I got, it said, "Mr. Gretton, your application has been dismissed."
Right. Now, there are 5 pages of terms and conditions on the SAI website, and if you go down to the 20s, I think it's just on the third page of them, it says all electrical work must be undertaken by a fully qualified and authorised electrician is number 25, but before that it says the applicant must engage a company listed on the SAI registered company list to carry out the supported measures. Mm-hmm. The company must be active on the SAI registered companies list at the time of application when the works have been carried out, which was the case when you got them carried out. Anyway, the SEAI effectively are telling you now that you have to go back to the original company, even though that ship has kind of sailed. You paid for the works and you haven't got the grant.
Yeah, that ship has well sailed, you know. And they're asking me to go back and look for paperwork of a sole trader, basically, that did work in my house 6 or 7 years ago. You know, it's the stuff that they're asking, you know, it's ludicrous in the extreme. You know, how am I going to deal with a fellow sole trader? He mightn't have any information.
Right.
I'm not sure, you know.
Right. They're putting it, the SAI says the onus is, the obligation is on the homeowner to choose a company that's registered with the SAI, which you did. And then it says after that, the obligation is on the company to only use Safe Electric certified installers. So they're putting it back on the company. But, you know, you feel, as you've outlined there, that you've done as much due diligence as you could do by going on the portal as you were directed.
Absolutely. Absolutely. So, but the question still comes back to who's checking the portal? Who's approving these installers to be on the portal?
What does the portal mean?
What does the portal mean?
What kind of approval is this? What is, if when they lay out all of those things that they say they're... the people on the portal are compliant with, what does that mean, and who inspects it and who makes sure it's up to date and that everybody is fully compliant? Is it self-reporting by the contractors that are on the portal, or are owners expected to drill down into company records every time a contractor shows up at their house? And as a result, I suppose you might ask, what's the point of the portal?
Absolutely, yeah. Where are they going with our portal, and who's checking it, and who's doing the balances, the checks and balances on it?
All right, Martin.
And from what I can see, there doesn't seem to be any checks and balances, because this issue arose 5 or 6 years ago. And from what I can gather, this fella is still on the portal. So he's still carrying out work.
All right. And, you know, as you say, we're not going to name him, but we have gone on the website of the contractor there, and he makes no claims to be registered with Safe Electric Ireland on his website. He just says he's a solar PV installer. So... anyway, you're left with no €1,200 grant, and you're not going to go ahead now with this upgrade of the solar panels, are you?
Well, you know, that's a choice that has to be made. Right. That's a choice that has to be made. Right. I'll talk to my wife about it, you know. Okay. Do we still go ahead? Are the savings, you know, are the electrical savings worth it? But We would like to think ourselves as green. So more than likely, we will go ahead of it, and we'll just have to take the hit for it.
Right, but you're feeling pretty sore about what the Portland led you to believe anyway.
Absolutely, or we may even take it further. You know, we might have to go down the legal route with this.
Right,
because when you put your faith in something, you expect them to be to have all their ducks in a row, and you would expect everything that they promote, and they're basically promoting this fella. And, lo and behold, he can't, he's not able to deliver.
Right. Well, they do say they don't stand over the quality of work carried out by the contractors. They just say that they are registered with them and fulfil certain minimum requirements on the portal. Mm. All right, Martin, look, it's obviously it's lesson learned, but it's one you'd rather not have spent that kind of money learning. We'll take a break. We're back in a minute. Colm O'Mungain here. Patrick Curran, good afternoon to you.
Hello, Colm. How are you?
How are you doing? Gaelscoil Clochvrac in Galway. Tell us about it.
Right, well, it's our local national school, and our numbers have dropped a little bit in the last few years, and they're looking like they're going to pick up again in the next few years. But this year, we're at a bit of a pinch point, because to keep the second teacher that's there, we need to enrol 7 junior infants in September.
And how far off are you? Off that are you?
We have 4, possibly 5 at the minute. We have 4 definite and a 5th maybe. And we really need 2 or 3 more. And we're offering a €2,000 bursary for anyone that starts in junior infants. So that's what we've decided to do to try and attract more kids.
Well, set the scene now. Where are you? Where are you situated? And don't hold back. Tell us about the scenery and where you are and the local beauty spots.
Well, if you're looking at a map of Ireland and you look at the west and you see Lochmask and Lochcarrig, two big lakes, we're smack bang in the middle between those two. We're right on the Galway-Mayo border. We're inside Connemara. We're in the Gaeltacht. It's what you can imagine, a picturesque setting of the west of Ireland. Mountains, lakes, green fields, stone walls, cows and sheep in the fields, all that kind of thing. Lots of outdoor pursuits. There's an outdoor education centre nearby. There's obviously fishing and swimming on the lakes and hiking and walking and all the usual things you'd associate. A couple of nice little villages, larger towns not too far away. Nice place to live, great place to grow up and great place to go to school.
An ancient battle site going back to Ireland's mythical past in the area.
Yeah.
The battle between the Tuatha Dé Danann and the Fir Bolg. So there's, it doesn't get more historic than that.
Yeah, it's the isthmus between the two lakes, and that's why Ashford Castle was set up there, commanding that isthmus. And when you're between those two lakes, if anyone wants to pass through, they're coming along here historically.
Right, so the village is Unarcha or Unarchy, which is Clonbur in English, in the heart of Joyce country.
Yeah, Unarcha is just maybe 5-6 minutes over the road from here. We're in on Clochvrac here.
Right.
And it's a small school. I went to school there myself, and my father went to school there, and it's we're always roughly between maybe 35 to 40 kids, always. That was the number that was always there. So 4 or 5 starting every year was a normal amount. That might sound pretty small to someone listening in a big town or city, but it's a small 2-classroom school, and it's actually a lot bigger now than it was when I was there. So there is actually loads of room there now.
Right. And what's the school experience like there? I mean, tell us about, give us a slice of what kids experience there every day going to school.
Well, the biggest difference is probably between here and your bigger schools are there's a mixed classroom. So the first four years will be in one classroom, and first, second, third, or the last 4 classes, fourth, fifth, sixth, third class, they'll be in another room. So the kids are picking up a little bit from the other classes as well. They all play together. That's one thing you will notice whenever you're around school or looking at the school. All the kids from the oldest to the youngest all play together. It's almost like watching a family playing together. And they do loads of different activities. And because it's a small school, they all do it together. So they do football together, they do music together, Irish dancing together, swimming, all the usual stuff that kids do. They have a science club. And everyone gets involved because it's so small and close-knit, which is great for kids to be interacting with older kids and younger kids. It's good for them.
Right. And kids, I suppose, who have, you know, good aptitude in reading, maths, whatever, probably have the opportunity to maybe go a couple of books ahead and do work with an older class and keep them stimulated.
Yeah, and if it's all going well for those kids, and then if you kids who are a little bit less adept at some of the subjects, you've got way more time with a teacher, like a lot more time with a teacher. The teacher has the time to spend with every kid because the student-to-pupil ratio or the student-to-teacher ratio was so low, they've got that extra time with the kids.
And what was it like when you were there?
It was like that. There was, I think, roughly around 36 when I was there and two teachers. And yeah, I suppose I didn't realise how lucky I had it at the time. But you see it when you go to secondary school, the other schools, they haven't provided the kids with the same amount of time. And look, a really, really gifted child is, you know, they're usually going to do well anyway, but the rest of us normal people, the more time we get, the better. So you know, I did notice when I went to secondary school, you were a little further ahead on a lot of subjects. You knew bits and pieces that the other kids maybe didn't. And yeah, you just had loads of time. If you didn't understand something, if like the class wasn't racing on ahead without you, you could ask whatever questions you want and things would slow down and you'd get that extra time.
Right. And for families, you know, if they were interested in sending their kids to school there, is it a requirement that they move to the area or just travel, you know, that their kids travel to the school?
Oh, no, they don't. They can live wherever they want. There's obviously, if they move here, it's probably going to be handier for them. But that's the idea of this bursary. It's if you're from outside of the immediate area, you are going to incur costs, extra travel expenses, you know, stuff like that, maintenance on the car, fuel, whatever. This money is for the parents or guardians to spend whatever way they choose. Now, it's not a first-come, first-served that everyone that shows up at the door gets €2,000. Like, that's
right.
It's not,
and would it be exactly paid on like a monthly that. Basis or is it paid up front? What way?
No, it's paid in two payments at Christmas. So the first year and then the second year that they're there, they get the second half of it. And they're encouraged to move to the area. It's a beautiful area to live, but if they can travel, then yeah. There's also a breakfast club in the morning, so you don't have to come at 9. The breakfast club starts at 8. And the after-school club is from 2 till 5:30. So it's very flexible for dropping off and picking up for any families.
Right. So three teachers there at the moment. I suppose the third teacher, it puts them in a bit of a predicament. They're probably watching pupil numbers anxiously, are they?
Yeah, well, it's a principal and two teachers. So like running a school now is almost like running a company with all the paperwork and whatnot. So obviously they want to stay there. And the biggest thing really is the next couple of years, there are a lot more kids in the area now. I suppose for the last 5 or 6, there hasn't really been any kids born in the area, really. But now, for the first time in a long time, it's actually looking pretty good.
Why is that?
So just more families have moved back. Several have been away. My young lad is starting in September, and one of my classmates' kids is also starting with him.
Right. Did people move back during COVID and have babies during that time that are now coming on stream for infants? Is that the reason for it or what?
That has happened. In my own case, it was during COVID that I actually moved back here, but I was moving back anyway, COVID or no COVID. And it hasn't just been that. There's just more people, more younger people living here now, and a lot of new houses have gone up in the area. And there's just more kids being born. There was a time there, maybe 5-6 years, where there wasn't. So the enrolments were very, very low. And that's what caused this situation we have right now. Now, for the next few years ahead, it's actually looking a lot better. But it's just this year in particular. Now, we're still going to continue on a campaign after this year because, obviously, the more kids, the better. But this year in particular, to keep the second teacher and to not have to try and get that second teacher back, it's a lot easier to... Prevention is better than a cure.
So you need about another, what did you say, 2 or 3 kids to get it across the line?
Yeah. Now, obviously, the more the merrier. It'd be great if we got loads more than that. But 2 or 3 is, we have bursaries available for 3. And that'll all be decided by the Board of Management who gets that. As I said, it's not going to be a first come, first serve.
Right.
You know, they'll obviously have to be a fit for the school.
And if a family had 3, do they get the 3 bursaries or do they only get 1?
Well, that's a good question, but the bursaries are aimed at junior infant kids. So if they have three, they have triplets, and I suppose they deserve all the help they can get.
Right, okay. Okay, and have you had that before? I mean, has it worked in other years? Have you had to do it before?
No, the last initiative like this, or similar to this, was a couple of years ago. It was on the news and on a couple of radio stations. They had a house, a free rent in a house for a year for a family. And that was taken up, and it worked well. A Spanish family moved here, and they got on really well in school, but they had legal family matters at home, and they had to go back to Spain.
Right.
Now, the reason we didn't go with that, again, this time, the free rent in a house for a year, is kind of all your eggs in one basket in that situation. So at least this way, it's shared out a bit more.
Right.
You know? Yeah.
And have you had people, you know, would it be feasible for people to send their kids out from the city?
Well, I suppose the nearest city is Galway. And
how far out would you be talking?
It's
an hour, is it?
50 minutes at least, yeah. Right. Look, if there's no traffic and you're going in the middle of the night, it's 45 minutes. But realistically, it's during the day. We're not really targeting people from Galway City, but there is towns not far away, like Ballinrobe, Cong, which I suppose more of a village. Castlebar isn't a million miles away. Like, you'd be there in 40, 45 minutes on any day of the week. And yeah, from any surrounding area, really.
So anyway, you've got the bursary, it's ready to roll. Any other particular selling points in the village itself? Like, what's life like there, like for a family, if people were to consider even a move there and avail of, you know, if people are considering a move somewhere anyway and this bursary tips them over the line? What's in Clochfrack and the area? You know, it's got the scenery, it's got the lakes, but, you know, what is there in terms of shops, pubs? And what's the vibe like people-wise?
It's very, very, very peaceful place to live. It's a different pace of life. Like, I've lived in big cities. I've lived in Vancouver and Johannesburg. I know what it's like to live in a city. I've lived in Galway. It's better for the soul to live and grow up in a place like this. You've got a really, really welcoming community. There's lots of local amenities. Now, obviously, they're not all in walking distance like they are if you live in the middle of Dublin City. But you've got... You're surrounded by nature. Like, you're not. Nature is around you all the time. The nearest village will be Clonbur. That's got all your usual restaurants, pubs, small supermarkets, church. You know, all the usual bits and pieces. You're going to have a nice bakery.
Mm.
It's the pace of life, I suppose. And I always wondered when I see people who have moved here from other areas, and I used to wonder, I wonder why did they choose here? And I have asked some of them, because I have a garage here, and a lot of my customers are not from here. And I've always asked them, how did you end up here? You know, why here in particular? And most people say, well, we came here on holidays, or we were visiting someone and we had to find a place to live here. We love it. It's you kind of have to see it to understand.
Right. And where did you move back from yourself? Where were you? Where were you away?
Well, I suppose over the years I was in Canada and South Africa. And then I lived maybe half an hour away from here in a town while just saving money to build a house. And then I moved back here. I've been self-employed for quite a while here, right across the road from the school. I can hear the kids playing at lunchtime from where I work.
But you were always going to move back, were you?
Always. I didn't realise what we had here until I had lived away, and I travelled in quite a few other places as well. And I've seen a good portion of the world now, and I never appreciated what we had here until I came back. And now I bless myself every day to see where I live and where my kids get to grow up. Whatever they decide to do once they've flown the nest, that's up to them. But what a place they're going to get to grow up in. I've seen what other kids have to live like. I'm not making it sound like Oliver Twist or anything, these other kids, but like, it is a special place to grow up around here and to go to school.
And you said there is new building going on there. Is there any issues with planning in the area for people who do want to move back? Because a couple of weeks ago I was up in Ballycastle in Mayo, and they were trying to encourage people back. They have a hub set up there for people to do remote working. There's companies, you know, spending either part of their time there or headquarter in there to try and encourage Ballycastle people and others to come back and live and work there. But the planning was one of the issues they said was a kind of a recurring issue. Is that a factor at all in the area there?
Look, all parts of rural Ireland, planning is... I don't really want to call it an issue, because I can't complain. I had absolutely no problem with my planning permission back in 2019. Like, no problem at all. I was getting ready for a big fight. It was no problem. But then I do know people who have had issues. And I don't think I know anyone who's been outrightly refused you know, that they can't do what they want to do within reason. Sometimes you have to change things around. I can't really complain about that, you know, because I had a positive experience of it. Now, outsiders, planning is different for them because you have to display like historic local ties to the area. But that doesn't stop people from buying in the area, or from if they buy somewhere and want to extend onto it, you know, that is the usual way for people to move into an area like this.
Right. And are people mostly...
They're not going to move here.
Yeah, are people mostly commuting from the area, or are people move back, you know, working locally, whether you obviously have a business that's, you know, a bit based there, you have a garage there, but, you know, are there people working from home? What's the kind of broadband like in the area for people to work from home if they're doing that?
The broadband is good. There is fibre broadband here now, and myself and I know quite a few more people who have their own broadband providers. I personally use Starlink, I find it good. But there is a digital hub just maybe a mile up the road from the school, and some people work out from there. And a lot of people work from home or do a bit of both. You know, they're a few days here and a few days at the office or wherever their place of work is. And quite a few more do commute. Yeah, there's a lot of people who do commute.
Right. You mentioned a bakery down the road. Is there Wi-Fi in the bakery?
Well, I'd imagine so, yeah. Right. I think there's got nice cakes anyway. Whatever about the Wi-Fi.
All right. That's great. Thanks a million, Patrick. Skull Nave Fáilc on Clochvrac is the website if you want to have a look at it. You've put out the call there. There's a bursary going for people to put their kids in the school, hopefully boost the pupil numbers and save a teacher for that school. Back in a minute.
Talk to Joe on 0818 715 815.
Colm O'Mungine here. Donny Anderson, good afternoon to you.
Good afternoon, Colm.
Give us a whistle.
How are you?
Go on, go again. Now, to explain to listeners, you run four dogs who respond to that whistle. How long have you been training sheepdogs?
Since I was going to school.
Going back to what age?
I suppose when I was 9 or 10, sure. Probably 9 or 10 when I got the first one, I'd say.
And how young does a sheepdog have to be to start training them?
Sure, they're like people. Sure, everyone is different. Some of them would start when they're... Like, I have one here, and I had her working at 3 months. And then I had another one. She was nearly 3 years before she started working well. So they're all different.
And are there many people in the game of training sheepdogs, Donny?
Sure. Most farmers that have sheep, especially the older farmers on the hills and all, sure, they would all be training dogs, train their own dog, most of them.
And any difference between dogs and bitches?
I find a bitch are nearly more loyal because you don't have the problem like where you have a dog, if there's a bitch around in heat or something, he'd be going smelling around the place looking for her, where a bitch won't be only for a couple of weeks of the year.
Right, not as easily distracted.
Exactly, now you said it, yeah.
Right. Is there any kind of standout dog that you remember training that, you know, was the cleverest of the pack?
She died a couple of years ago. She would have been good all-round dog, like, you know. She could do tricks and things like that as well as working well. And they're all very good with people as well, and that's one of the main things that you can kind of trust them fairly well.
And how many dogs would you have on the go training at any one time? And what do you do with them then when you have them fully trained? Do you keep them or sell them on to somebody else?
I usually keep most of them. Like, it's hard enough to get a good one that does everything. So when you have a good one, you're inclined to hold on to them and work with them. And sure, they don't be long getting old either. Like, you know, they get a few years and then they start to slow down and you have a younger one coming on then to take their place.
And how have you ever done this competitively? Have you ever gone to a sheepdog trial and tried your hand at them?
I do a bit, yeah.
How'd you get on?
I wouldn't be the best because I don't really put enough effort into it because I do have ordinary work. So the ordinary work is more important. It's the most important thing first of all, and then you have to do the trials comes after that. Like, you know, for me anyway.
And is it on the way out at all? Because you do see people on quads around farms. You know, will that ever replace the sheepdog, do you think?
Maybe in lowland situations, but on the hills and all, sure, it's very hard to do anything with it. Like, there's places where we'd be going with sheep and you wouldn't get there with a quad. You'd be hard set to walk to it, like, you know.
Yeah, and what part of the world are you in?
And we're up the Dublin Hills, just on the foot of Kipure there.
So you definitely need a dog. You're not going to be accessing all of that on a quad.
No, no.
Tom O'Sullivan, good afternoon to you.
How are you, Colm? Good, good.
You're into this business in a competitive way.
Well, yeah, both, I suppose, like Tony was saying there, the border collies, the sheepdogs, they're, first and foremost, they're work dogs and they're pets as well, I suppose, but they're at home, they're... They have to get the day's work done, first of all. But yeah, I compete as well and enjoy that side of it, I suppose.
Right, you're being modest now, Tom. You've represented Ireland in One Man and His Dog.
Yeah, a few years back, yeah. We were asked to compete with one of our dogs and One Man and His Dog back in 2022. So yeah, we're quite chuffed, I suppose.
Yeah, how'd you get on?
That phone call. Good, yeah, we won that competition that day. Yeah, things went our way and Tess had a good run and we brought trophy back to Ireland, so happy with that.
All right, tell us about the dog, the winning dog.
Her name is North Hill Tess, I suppose. I've been, like, similar to Donny there, probably a bit younger than Donny, but I'm training dogs since I was young, 10 years old, family farm, realised very quickly you need a dog and kind of bought one and realised how to train them and I've put various dogs through my hands over the years that have been successful, but there's something special about Tess since a young age. Got her from a good friend of mine over in Wales, a man called Kevin Evans, bought her as a pup and she just has this ability to just settle the wildest of sheep at a sheepdog competition. They can be all different breeds and you have to assess as a handler how to control them and then the distance to keep the dog back from them and all that. And she just has a way of settling sheep. It's something that's a bit special. So yeah,
why is it different? You know, how can one dog manage it better than the others? Is that, you know, can sheep sense the anxiety of one dog, or maybe does she use less aggression, or what is it about?
Yeah, I think they can sense the anxiety and the tension in the dog at times, like, you know, and the more relaxed the dog is moving, the more relaxed the sheep are. Now, having said that, they have to be authoritative in movement and stuff like that to move sheep, the same as if you're at home on a farm. If a dog doesn't move towards sheep, the sheep aren't going to move away from them, you know, so... Yeah, it's all about working as a team, basically, man, dog, and then trying to control sheep, and it's not easy. You can be winning one day, and the next day you could be on the bottom of the pecking order again. So that's the good thing about the sport, I suppose.
And where does the name come from, North Hill Tess?
It comes from their breeder. So some breeders would have a prefix, and it just kind of follows on with the breed, and so. She was bred around Pembroke in Wales there. So there's a man there called Robert Lewis, and his prefix is North Hill. So that's where that came from.
Right.
Some people have prefixes, some people don't. But yeah.
And you said she's a working dog, but and also a pet. Does she sleep in the house or outside?
And she was sleeping outside. She's actually inside the utility room in night time now. She's getting old. She's 9 years old, and the older they get, like ourselves, the stiffer they get.
Right.
When
she won the cup, you had to give her an upgrade anyway.
Yeah, you had to give her a bit of an upgrade. Yeah.
Right. Donny, can I ask you? You know, people would say that a strange dog would worry a sheep. Farmers make annual appeals for people to keep control of their dogs. What's the difference between introducing a sheep dog to a flock of sheep and a strange dog just wandering into the field? How do sheep know the difference?
It's probably because that's the kind of a dog they're used to. They don't. Sometimes you'd be hoping that sheep would go a lot quicker from your dog, but the sheep just get to know the dog and as Tom says, like the dog won't frighten them too much, especially in a trial. But I just say to people, if something like a Jack Russell comes into the field, the sheep would be more frightened than they would be from the big sheepdog like that they're used to. You know, and you'd be hoping the sheepdog sometimes would frighten them when you're under pressure trying to get sheep in or something, but it doesn't just happen, and the sheep respect the dog enough not to, and they don't run away from it either. And the thing about what you mentioned about dogs worrying sheep or something like that, the thing is that the sheep will run, and a dog will run away from run after anything that runs away from it, like in a worrying situation. So the sheepdog will be under control, that you can stop them and tell them when to go and when not to go.
So does the behaviour of sheep, the better they get to know a dog, does the behaviour of the flock of sheep change towards it, and does the dog kind of have to adapt to get the sheep to obey it?
They do, yeah, and you'd be surprised how well the sheep get to know the dog. If you had a dog that wasn't good enough to move them, the sheep wouldn't be long telling you, because they just wouldn't move.
Is it a bit like classroom management in secondary school, that, you know, the pupils always have to be kind of kept an eye on? They get used to the teacher, and the teacher might have to change it up a bit over the course of the school year.
They'd find the soft spots in them, wouldn't they?
They would.
The same with the sheep, with the dog. Like, if you have a dog that's not good enough or hasn't got power to move on, the sheep won't be long about telling you.
Right.
They act up.
So the dog, you know, needs a kind of an intelligence that adapts to the behaviour of the sheep. They're pretty smart animals.
Oh, God, it's hard to believe how smart they are, like, you know. As I often say to people, it's the people that think, like, the dog is smart. The people just, even some of the farmers, and it could be the same myself, because you don't realise actually how brainy the dog is till you see him doing something like that you don't expect, maybe.
What kind of a price are people paying for dogs, you know, who are up to that standard?
Sure, there's all kinds of prices going. Since COVID, there has been a good few online auctions, and dogs are making a lot of money. I don't know what kind of people. Tom would be more in the circle. Like, you know, not Tom would know a lot of the people that would be able to breed dogs good enough to sell them in that. I wouldn't be good enough for that. But
what's the dearest dog you've ever heard of?
I think there was a dog made 20-something thousand there in one of the auctions back a couple of years ago. And like in the online auctions, like, there'll be people from all over the world buying them, I'm sure. Like, some of the Irish dogs are as good as anywhere in the world. And then there's Welsh dogs and Scottish people, they're all good dogs. But with the online, people anywhere in the world can buy a dog, like, look at him on a video or something and buy him, where not like it used to be years ago.
And how far afield are dogs brought in from, Tom? Because obviously, you know, New Zealand, Australia have a name for having massive sheep farms. Would dogs come from that far away, or do people in this part of the world tend to keep it pretty local when it comes to breeding dogs?
Not so much Australia, New Zealand. I suppose down there you had the Kelpie and the New Zealand Huntaway and dogs, herding dogs like that, whereas up in the kind of northern hemisphere, we've border collies a lot. I suppose, to be quite honest with you, like, the border collie originates from the borders between Scotland and England, so it's there where the home of the border collie is. And over the years, I suppose the Irish now were well known in the around the world for the handlers and the dogs being produced here, I suppose, which is a good thing. And if you look back over the breeding of the dogs, a lot of them are coming from UK, Wales, Scotland, England, and the Irish breeding as well. So,
right. Do you breed them yourself?
Sometimes, yeah. Sometimes we'd always like to have maybe one litter a year, and sometimes we'd have some customers looking for puppies, and I would pick one then, maybe, and I've a litter at the moment, and I've picked one, and my daughter, who's 14, has picked one as well, and we'll see what becomes of that. Maybe she might take on the skill in time, but it's a lottery whether those puppies we pick are going to turn out to be working dogs or not. And if they don't, you try and find a family home for them, for someone that lives a fairly active life, like. But It's a lottery whether they work right. or not, but the breeding helps.
And Donny, when you're looking at a litter of pups, how do you know which one to pick, or what's your best, what kind of guides your best guess as to what's a good dog to pick when they're that small and that young?
It's really very hard to know. You might see a pup that you liked. One of the ones that I have now, the man that bred her, like she's 5 mile dog at home, but he said all the other pups used to be looking out over the door trying to get out. But this one was actually looking at the bottom of the door waiting for it to open. And she turned out the right one, like, you know. So, and that was when she was a small pup. So it was very hard to know. And I had her picked out from the time she was born, like, because I just liked the look of her. And she had a bit of tan on her, which I liked. And, you know, but it's luck as well. Like, I could have picked out a wrong one as well. Most of them turned out good, that litter. But, like, it's never know when a pup is that small which one is going to be the right one. So it's, like, it's a lot of luck as well. And if the breeding is in them, it's 99% or 90% anyway that they're going to be fairly good. They mightn't all be trial dogs, but they could make a good farm working dog.
And is there always one person, is like at a family enterprise training dogs, or is there normally one person in the family who gravitates towards training a dog that maybe has a better handle on it than others?
I suppose the person that's doing the most with the sheep is the one that'll have the best dog, I suppose. Because if you're not working every day, it's hard to have a good dog, you know, if you're not doing something with them all the time. Or they're not doing serious trialing. Like.
Yeah, definitely. Donald's hit the nail on the head there. Right? The person that's out working every day with sheep. And there's a great saying in Ireland, like a good dog is worth up to 10 people on the farm. You know, and if you're out running around after sheep without a dog, you'll find out that statement's very true very quickly. There's families about, like there's sons and grandsons and there's people I know that their grandsons are competing and training, and there's like all those people they need a dog at home first and foremost. Like that's important to point out, that just a competition dog just isn't a competition dog. It's at home doing the work every day and trying to do the things every day just as much as the general farm dog, you know.
Right. And your daughter, you said you were going to give a pup to your daughter. Are there many women involved in it?
There's a few, yeah. There's a few. There was actually a lady competing in the one man and his dog competition that year in the final for England. There are good handlers that are both female and male out there, like so. It's definitely something for everyone,
right? And Donny, I've heard people, you know, women coming from abroad involved in this as well. I mean, is it mostly still men involved in it because they're out and about with the sheep on a day to day basis?
That's probably one of the reasons. It's probably changing a bit, like, but there are a few women competing for Ireland now that have come from other countries, and they're very good handlers, and probably because they did it more at home, where there's not that many women really here. Probably, I don't know why, whether it's, like, there's a few great ladies doing it, and sure, they're probably better than the men if they had the time to do it, maybe because they have a lot of other things to be doing, where they're not maybe having the time to be working at sheep all the time. But it's just, like a lot of things, women have a great way with animals, you know, so they probably would. They'd be good at it.
All right. Tom, before we go, can you give us a whistle? Or are you a whistler, or do you use something for that?
Oh, I've the plastic whistle around my neck here.
Give us a lash of it there. There you go. Hope that didn't drive every dog in the country mad. We'll take a break. Back in a minute. 087-484-8888 for your WhatsApp. Sharon Stewart, good afternoon to you.
How are you?
Good, thanks. You were listening in yesterday afternoon. We were talking to parents and indeed barbers who are, well, in the case of parents, they were looking for a barber for kids with sensory issues. But we had barbers and hairdressers on offering their services to kids with sensory issues, including kids with autism. That's the area you're in, is it?
It is, of course, yeah. I heard plenty of messages came to my phone yesterday saying that the interview was on online, and I got straight on, but unfortunately I was working yesterday, so I couldn't ring in.
Right. And
But lovely to talk to you.
Yeah, tell us about your operation.
So look, I do sensory haircuts for kids with additional needs that don't that can't make it into barbershops and hairdressers, that find it too overwhelming. And I find that doing the home visits in their house, it cuts out that middleman, that place to try and get a kid who has additional needs into a hairdresser's, is very overstimulating for them. And I find by the time they get into the hairdressers, that not only have they dealt with trying to get there, they've sensed the stress off their parents, they now have the stress on them. They're going into a salon that might have hair dryers, razors, noise, music. The haircuts are relevant by then because they're completely overwhelmed, and they've had to deal with all that before the haircut takes place. So, Joe, what I offer is I go to the client's house, keep everything very calm. You can keep the parents calm, which initially doesn't lead on to the child then. And you can build a relationship with the child and get their haircut.
Right. And do you work in a salon at all? Salon at all, or did you, you know, are you a home-based hairdresser in terms
I'm a home-based hairdresser. Yeah, I do 2 weeks. I was working in a barbershop 2 days a week. I've done full-time hairdressing, and I just have gone into home haircuts for kids with additional needs.
Yeah, and how did you get into it?
I got into it from two sides, seeing kids coming into the barbershops and not being able to tolerate the noise and running out halfway through haircuts. And then you'd felt sorry for the parents who had to obviously go home with a child with a half a haircut because the child wasn't able for the session. And secondly, my sister had two kids with additional needs and she couldn't make it anywhere. And only because I was able to have her, the kids' haircuts, she never would have been able to get them done. So that kind of opened my eyes a lot, to be honest with you. And I just love being able to go and help out people. If it's one less struggle that a family can have, I just love doing it.
Yeah, and how do you set up in the home that kind of reduces the stress on the parents so the kids aren't sensing it from them, and to make a child comfortable with getting their hair cut when they do have sensory issues?
Yeah, great question. I leave it up to the kids, and that's not being honest. If I have to cut their hair on the table, on the floor, on the roof, I'll do it anywhere. That's it. Like, there's no structure that they have to sit in their chair, that they have to have, they have to stay still. I will follow the child around, or we'll do what the child wants.
Can you cut it on the move?
Play sand, you can cut it on the move.
How do you do that?
By following the child around, and like that, some children will let you do a section, or some kids will stop halfway through, and you stop with them. You give them their time. There's no rush, and that's what I think really helps. Because in the barbershop, you're assigned to a time. You have a time slot, and you have to get in because you've another client coming in. Whereas when I go in, I'll set aside an hour minimum. So whether I get the haircut done in the hour. Whether you get some kids when you're first initially starting off, you might only get a fringe trim. But it's about building a relationship with the child. And like I say to every parent, it's a journey. You're not going to go in and get a full haircut straight away when the child doesn't know you. Some kids you will. It just, every kid's additional needs are different.
Right. But sure, I mean, look, I suppose.
And
even,
that's just.
Even half a haircut came into fashion. They called it a mullet. But they're.
Very true, very true. And look, like that, you can build a relationship, get their fringe, get it out of the right, get where it's annoying them. And you'll build up a relationship with the child, and the child will get used to you coming into their home as well.
Amanda, you do it in your salon. So you people do come in, but you have it adjusted so that people enjoy the sensory experience that you've set up.
Yeah, exactly, yeah. I own a barbershop in Walkinstown. It's the Grafton Barbers there on the roundabout, and we're one of the first Grafton Barbers to have a sensory room in the barbershop. So obviously kids that want to come in, it's the same what everyone has been saying yesterday and today, the noise of the hairdryers, the lights, the music, people talking, people laughing, it gets so overwhelming at the door. And for their moms to be able to support them in down the back, it's like a closed off room, door closed behind you, and you're in the sensory room.
Okay, now describe it to us, because you have sent us in some pictures, and it's, you know, not an ordinary room. You have it set up with all sorts of colours and low lighting and everything else. Tell us what you have in there and why.
Yeah, no problem. So I worked alongside the sensory house up in Tally, and I explained to them basically what I wanted to do, and I wanted to be able to have an area to bring children or adults, any neurodiverse people, into a room that is away from the hustle and bustle of the shop. So it's a corridor unit and has a bubble tube in the corner and has fibre optics coming out onto the floor. So it's like a padded area in one half of the room. I have a chair there that's optional as well, that the kids, some kids want it, the older they are. Younger kids, like the last lady says, you cut on the go. So I have a table that can either have the Kinetic Sand in it, or I can put water in it, and I have little tiles down to go in the water as well. Obviously, one sensory sensitivity for one kid is not the same for every kid. So some kids love the sand, some people hate it. Same with the water. 9 times out of 10, the water is a go. Like, it distracts them, and you're able to interact and play with them as well. I have magnetic tiles that I could try and use. I have loads of different things in the room, just that they get distracted so much by what's around them. And I have projectors on the ceiling and stuff as well, and mirrors, and it's just, there's so much. If one thing doesn't work, it's like you just move on to the next, and then you try and learn a little bit there, and that doesn't work, you move on to the next. Like,
right. And so the bubble towers you have set up, they're like long, clear perspex cylinders, and the water bubbles up through them, and you can change the colour of lights, and it kind of has this, yeah, a similar effect to kind of nearly like a volcano lamp.
Yeah, it's like one of the lava lamps from way back when, but it's just a water pump in it.
Right.
So it's about 6 foot, 7 foot tall, and I'd say it's about 6 inches, like, radius kind of thing. So it's a big enough tube. Like, the little boys and girls tend to stand up beside it, and you'd be staring at the bubbles, and you can sit around with their legs wrapped around it, whichever way they feel comfortable. And there's shatterproof acrylic mirrors around it, that, like, they can see themselves, and they can see the bubbles reflecting off it. And if I'm cutting their hair, I tend to go with working up a relationship first. So it's not just like straight in the room, sit down, you're getting your hair cut. I'm kind of getting to know each child that comes in, what they like to do, what they like to watch. There's a TV in the room as well, so if they watch that, and in particular that distracts them or comforts them, I'm able to put on the telly. And I've had a few women messaging me in just to say, my son or daughter won't come near a barbershop. How do we get over that? Like, I want to be able to bring them in like I do my other kids or something like that, but they just scream when they get to the door. It's always
right.
Being,
do you have a back door you can bring them in?
I bring them in the front door, but I do, myself and my partner have worked on a social story that I can email out to customers. So when they book in, I send out a social story, and it has a picture of the shop, the way to the sensory room, what I'm going to use, everything else.
The social story is a step-by-step picture, so the parents can show the kids step-by-step how the haircut and the trip to the barbers is going to go, and at least they can do some level of preparation with those pictures. Is that it?
Exactly, yeah.
Right. And Sharon, when you're going out on a home visit, I mean, do you have any advice for parents maybe to reduce the sensory overload in the home environment? Do you ask them to reduce the lighting, make sure there's not additional noise to what you're going to be doing? What kind of advice do you give parents for people for when you're doing a home visit?
Yeah, exactly. Like that, I'll get them to either set them up with an activity, or I will get an activity set up with them. I bring some sensory toys with me, like that, different toys, different distractions. And I'll send a photo the day before of me so they know who's coming to the house, or even a few days before the appointment, and they can get to show their children it's me coming, so at least it's familiarised them with me. That's how I go about it.
Right. And is smell, and you both come in on this, is smell a part of it at all? Is there any particular, you know, smell, be it in the salon or in the home, that do you ask parents to, you know, have some form of a familiar smell, seeing as it's a whole sensory experience for kids?
That's individual to every child.
Yeah. There's eight different senses that an autistic child goes through. So the sense of smell is a big thing, and you kind of need to go with them. Like, a lot of kids can start to stim a lot, and If they're stimming in a good way and they're happy, like, you'd like to encourage it and keep them happy. And then if it's some kids can lose control and go straight into fight, flight or freeze mode and trying to get, you know, making sure they know that they're safe and that their parents are there to support them and that we're there to support them and not hurt them. And it can be a whole process, like.
Right. But at the end of the day, it gets the result in a lot of cases that you want by taking that bit of extra time and care. Sharon, Amanda, thanks a million for that. We're back in a minute. Margaret O'Keefe, good afternoon to you.
Good afternoon, Colin.
In the minute we have left, you wanted to say thanks to a couple who helped you. You got off the Lewis and you took a bit of a fall and they helped you out. Colin. Tell us about that.
They did. It was about 6:45 in the evening time I got off the Lewis, and I don't think there was anyone else getting off the Lewis at that particular time. It's normally there would be. And I don't know what happened, whether I tripped, I think, on the path, and down I went. And the chap ran to my assistance and the girl came after him. And because I've had a knee and a hip replacement a couple of years ago, I'm not able to, because I was down on the ground, I wasn't able to help myself up. So they helped me up and they were very, very kind. And it's just, I thanked them, but I feel it wasn't enough because they were so nice, so caring, and they were only a very young couple. I don't know, I didn't know their names. I know they definitely were not Irish because they spoke broken English. They were on their way to a barbecue. And I just want to say thank you very, very much indeed. Yeah.
Right. And Camir, I believe you're a Scrabble champion. What's your highest world
score? I'm not a champion.
Go on, you're very modest. What's your highest world score that you know about?
No, I'm not. We play for fun, but I actually went over on Wednesday after I was talking to your researcher, and I very seldom win, but I actually won the second game. But that's about it. No, I'm not great. It's all for fun. All for fun.
Okay, but it comes good every so often. Margaret, thanks a million for that. That's our lot for today. On sound was James Feeney. Our broadcast coordinator was Mary Elizabeth Bruton. The researcher was Richie Byrne. And the producer today was Sean O'Gorman. Raise next.